You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Well, thanks for coming, you guys. My name's Shane. I teach our high school central teaching that meets up here at Building X every week. Got back from leading our summer camp last week for high schoolers where they run me to death. And then this week I got the plague. So if I drop dead, someone pop up here and click through my slides and guess what I was going to say. What I wanted to talk about was this example of leadership that we find in the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah has always been viewed as this exemplary leader in the scope of the Bible, but I was reading it last year during the pandemic, and as I was revisiting the book, this thing began to emerge to me. What seemed especially interesting and cool about Nehemiah's leadership was the way that he stepped up to the plate in a time of extreme upheaval and uncertainty. And so I thought there'd be some cool principles that we could draw from this on what it looks like to be a servant leader. Someone who tries to put themselves out there and helps to grow God's kingdom, his church, during times of uncertainty. So, first thing we want to do here is we want to orient ourselves in the book of Nehemiah and where it sits in the scope of the Old Testament narrative, because it's important to understand the times that Nehemiah stepped up into to lead. This is a view that a guy by the name of Moses had 1,000 years before the events of the book, standing on top of Mount Nebo, looking out over the promised land. Moses, he's about to die. He's never going to enter into this land that God promised his people. And he's sitting up at this spot looking at this beautiful land that the Israelites are going to take over and they're going to inhabit. And it's in this spot that he writes this warning to God's people, this encouragement, this call for them to stick in with God and listen to him. He says in Deuteronomy 28, "If you fully obey the Lord your God and carefully follow all his commands I give you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations on earth. The Lord will grant that the enemies who rise up against you will be defeated before you. They'll come at you from one direction and flee from you in seven. The Lord will send a blessing on your barns and on everything you put your hand to. The Lord your God will bless you in the land he's giving you. However, if you do not obey the Lord your God and do not carefully follow all his commands and decrees I'm giving you today, all of these curses will come on you and overtake you. A people that you do not know will eat what your land and labor produce, and you'll have nothing but cruel oppression all your days. The sights you see will drive you mad. The Lord will inflict your knees and legs with painful boils that can't be cured, spreading from the soles of your feet to the top of your head." All right. So Moses gives them two options, option A and option B. You stick in there with God, you listen to him, you follow his leadership, and he's going to bless you. You're going to be fruitful. You're going to have his protection and bounty and blessing. Or if you turn away from him, if you ignore his leadership, if you worship false gods, if you go your own way, well, he's going to remove his protection. You're going to be conquered by people you don't know. And eventually you're going to wind up with painful boils from your head to your toes. So option A, protection, bounty, blessing. Option B, boils and slavery. You'd think that that was a pretty easy decision. You'd think that they would want to listen to God and follow his leadership. But apparently it wasn't so simple. It's kind of like for my high school guys every year before we go to summer camp, I lay out to them I give them this ultimatum every single year. This is one of my guys, Vlad, at camp dealing energy drinks out of his patent leather briefcase. I tell these guys every single year, I'm like, you got two options. Either the night before camp you go to bed and you have a good week, or you do what you always do, which is stay up all night before we leave, and by day three, you'll be a complete zombie. And of course, every year, they don't listen to me. They stay up all night, and by the second or third day of camp, I'll just find them sitting in random places with this vacant look on their face, like they're having war flashbacks. It's like, well, it's because you didn't listen. You've been up for 80 hours straight. That's what happens. The extreme foolishness, that's the level that the Israelites are on. They hear this clear warning from the Lord, and yet what you get for most of the Old Testament is 1,000 years of them ignoring this. going their own direction, throwing off God's leadership, and so eventually the wheels fall off. 587 BC, Nebuchadnezzar sweeps through, destroys Jerusalem, tears down every stone, brick by brick, he destroys the temple, and he leaves them in wreckage. All the people of Judah are swept away into exile. Doomsday. Something that we couldn't even imagine. Imagine being thrown out of your homes, the city of Columbus destroyed brick by brick, and marching out of here led away by an enemy people. That's what happens to these guys. And so everything that they know, their whole history, their culture, it gets destroyed in one moment, and they go off into exile. That's where Nehemiah is born, in exile. About 50 years after this, there's a guy by the unfortunate name of Zerubbabel who asked for permission to go back to the ruins of Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. And so he starts this building project, and they succeed. We read about this in the book of Ezra. They rebuild the temple. But eventually the work stalls. They're not able to fully rebuild the city. They start to work on the walls, and word gets back to the Persian emperor, and he says, stop. Because at this time, to do that, to try to construct city walls, that was always interpreted as an act of rebellion, right? If I'm a little people group and I wanted to rebel from the big guy, what would I do? I would build really tall walls, and I would try to survive a multi-year-long siege that would eventually happen. And so they're like, no, stop, stay put. You can have that temple, but the city remained in destruction. The walls broken down. And so honestly, this would have been a comical sight. You've got this big ornate temple in the middle of a burned out city with a bunch of ragtag remnant people living in ramshackle shacks all around it. And so this is the situation that Nehemiah enters into in 445 BC. Chapter 1, it says, in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men. And I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile and also about Jerusalem. So here we situate ourselves with who Nehemiah was. He's living in Susa, so this is a main city in the Persian Empire. And we go on to find in this chapter that he was a prominent official in King Artaxerxes' court. We learn that he was the cupbearer, which means that it was his job. Every day before Artaxerxes would drink his wine, Nehemiah would taste the wine to check if there was poison. So if Nehemiah drops dead, then Artaxerxes doesn't drink the wine. But this is actually a pretty important job. You would need someone there that you would trust. And so he has one of his brothers, Hanani, from Jerusalem, comes to him. And he shares with them the situation that the exiles are in back in Jerusalem. They said to me, those who survived the exile are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire. When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. So Nehemiah hears about this state that Jerusalem is in. Destroyed. The people living in this decrepit, broken down city, constantly afraid. And he weeps. He's moved. He acknowledges how destitute and desperate of a situation that this is. And so it's important to understand what Nehemiah ends up doing here, the leadership that we see in this book, the context that it occurs in. Because the leadership that Nehemiah is going to offer up, it comes during a time of extreme upheaval and uncertainty. When you step back and look at the situation, you can understand why the Israelites found themselves in this spot and why they were leaderless at this point. Because things were so uncertain. They were so desperate. They were so dire. So the city of Jerusalem, it's in ruins. It's been destroyed. Nebuchadnezzar, he had a bone to pick with them. Jerusalem was famously this rebellious city. They had somehow dodged all these different empires. And so finally, when Nebuchadnezzar sacked the city, he made sure that he really destroyed it. He didn't kind of destroy it. He really messed up Jerusalem. It's in total ruins. Because of this, the people are always living in fear for their lives. So they've got all these enemies that have crept in to areas that the Israelites historically owned and have essentially surrounded the city. They're allowed to live there, kind of carving out a living for themselves in and around the city, but they're constantly afraid. Because they don't have any walls. They look out their homes at night and they can see these armies encamped on the hills around them, living in constant fear every day. Part of the report was that the gates had been burned by fire. We get the impression that there were intermittent raids on the city throughout this time, where these enemies of the Israelites basically wanted to make sure that they stayed in their place, that they didn't rise to power as a regional power again. They're living in total financial destitution. They're completely impoverished. We find that there was a famine going on during the time. At this point, they're kind of hemmed into this little box, this small region around Jerusalem by these different enemies. So they don't have access to the fertile lowland regions that they formerly did during the zenith of their power. And so the product of this is that they're up in the hills in Jerusalem in the middle of a famine, trying to carve out an existence, and they're starving. They're dying. Their identity, their cultural and personal identity has been torn to shreds. Because for a millennia, they understood themselves. Whenever they thought about themselves, their personal and cultural identity was wrapped up in this idea that we are a people chosen and protected by God. And this city, Jerusalem, this is God's place that he takes care of. This is the city that he stamped his name on. So when they thought about themselves and their personal identity, that was the first thing that came to mind. You read countless things like this in the Old Testament, like David in Psalm 125 saying, those who trust in the Lord, they're like Mount Zion, which can't be shaken but endures forever. As the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds his people now and forevermore. This is the way they thought and conceived of themselves. David, he's sitting up looking at the mountains surrounding Jerusalem, and he's like, who could break down these mountains? Think about this city. Think about God's protection on this place. Oh, yeah, of course we're people loved by God. And so imagine thinking this way for a millennia, and then all of a sudden God says, all right, my protection's gone. And your home is destroyed and you're swept away into slavery. Their sense of self and identity, it's totally torn to shreds. They'd be asking themselves big existential questions like, are we not God's people anymore? Does he not care about us? Have we lost his protection? And finally, even if someone was trying to step up to the plate and lead in this situation, any action that they took would be viewed as a rebellion, a revolt by the king. You couldn't just start to build walls in a city that was labeled as rebellious. And so even if someone wanted to step up in the to the plate and lead here, they would become enemy number one with the most powerful man in the entire world. And so when you look at this situation, as I was sitting here in the middle of the pandemic reading this, what emerged to me through the pages was the incredible uncertainty that God's people were facing. When you step back and look at this, you can understand that the result, the product of all this, is they had no leader. They were aimless, they were leaderless, they were directionless because of how uncertain and dire the situation was. Maybe there were people around who cared, that saw the plight, that saw the straits that they were in. But then when they looked at the list that I just shared, they said to themselves, what's anyone supposed to do? Who's going to step up and lead during these uncertain times? And the big thing, the reason why this happens is during times like this, leading for God, it feels unrealistic. When you look at the list of problems, even if you have good intentions, you say, well, being a servant leader, influencing people for Christ, it feels unrealistic, unattainable. And man, this is why this emerged as something that I really wanted to talk with you guys about, because I don't need to pitch you on what it's like to live through uncertain times. I don't need to come up with a big sales pitch on what it's like to go through a period of upheaval where it feels like the whole world got flipped on its head overnight. Or you may have good intentions to go out and try to influence people and help push people closer to God, help people come to know God. But you say to yourself, what can anyone do during these uncertain times? Boy, this is what I think is really cool about studying this book and this example of Nehemiah. Because I think what really emerges as we sit and think about this is that during times of upheaval and uncertainty, I think that this is what servant leaders are really born and bred for. That funny enough, times of uncertainty are often when God is able to use servant leaders the most, when they're the most needed. And I think that in our situation, this is why this is something that I felt burdened to talk about. Because there could be so many reasons to look at our setting right now and be like, it feels unrealistic. We had a pandemic flip our world on its head. We live in a culture that's divided, torn in two, where half the population is militantly inclined to hate the other half of the population. A culture that's increasingly post-Christian, where back in the day, 10 or 20 years ago, people thought, well, you can believe whatever you want to believe. But now it's shifted, where it's kind of like you can believe whatever you want to believe, unless it's that Bible stuff. Then we have a problem. You got people trapped in isolation, so addicted to their autonomy and tech that they don't even realize the gaping holes in their lives for real relating and connection. It could be so easy in our situation to say, well, it just feels unrealistic to try to lead home churches, help drive people closer to God. So that's why we're going to study Nehemiah's example. And what we're going to look at here is four lessons from Nehemiah, what it looks like for servant leaders to lead through uncertainty in situations like where I think we find ourselves right now. The first lesson, during times of uncertainty, servant leaders cling to prayer. So like I said, Nehemiah, he gets this bad report, and then we find in the rest of chapter 1, he just spends a couple of months praying. He doesn't do anything. He just prays again and again for months on end. And then he comes up with this harebrained scheme at the start of chapter 2. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me, why does your face look so sad when you're not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. So Nehemiah shows up with the wine, and we get this interesting detail that he's got this sad look on his face, and he never looked sad in the king's presence before. And so if I'm the king, right, and I've got this wine taster whose job is to check for poison, I'm going to be pretty attentive to his facial expressions, right? And he sips that wine, and I start seeing him go, I'm going to feel pretty nervous. But so Artaxerxes sees his face, and he's like, is he choking? No, I think this dude's just sad. And he's clearly a licensed counselor. He says, this must be sadness of the heart. This detail, Nehemiah had never been sad in his presence before. This is from John White in a great book on Nehemiah, Excellence in Leadership. He says the palace protocol demanded that the king's servants always look happy. Gloom was not to cloud the royal happiness. Therefore, if Nehemiah one day allowed his face to slip, I conclude that he does so deliberately. Okay, so there was like a law in the king's court that you couldn't look sad. Which I think is hilarious. This is like the most powerful guy on the planet. And he has to have a law that nobody's allowed to look sad around me. Nobody. It's like a petulant four-year-old at her birthday party. Nobody's sad here. No one. Nobody. And then one kid starts crying and everybody's crying. Except in this case, you start crying in the courtroom, you get your head slapped off. So White concludes that this was a deliberate action on Nehemiah's part. This is something thought out. He's like, I'm going to bait him into an interaction because he's going to throw out this request to go back and rebuild Jerusalem. I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and its gate has been destroyed by fire? The king said to me, what is it you want? Imagine this. Imagine standing in front of the most powerful person on the planet, and he says to you, what do you want? What's your request of me? What do you think that Nehemiah would do in this situation? Is he going to lean on his position and influence? Is he going to lean on his well-crafted plan and scheme and carefully concocted arguments? What does Nehemiah do in this situation? The most powerful man on the planet says, what do you want from me? And then I pray to the God of heaven. He pauses and he prays. And he's been praying for months about this, but in this moment he stops and he prays. And I answered the king, if it pleases the king and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried so that I can rebuild it. And so he makes his request, send me back. And what happens? Artaxerxes answers his request. He not only lets Nehemiah go back to rebuild Jerusalem, but he gives him all the money and resources that he needs to go make this thing happen. When you read this book, it's obvious that Nehemiah viewed what happened here as a response to the prayer that he made to God. It's clear. All throughout the first two chapters, the thing that he highlights was his careful, constant intercession. He believed that this incredible, miraculous thing, it was the result of his persistent, incessant prayer. And man, I think that this is a really important example because during times like this, where things feel shaky and uncertainty, there's a tendency that the first thing that we ditch, that we throw away, is prayer. Because what we feel like we need to do is we need to take control of the situation. We got to plan and we got to figure out all the little details. And I'm not saying that we should be lazy here. There's a time and a place for planning and action, and we're going to see that from Nehemiah. But the point is that the last thing that we should ditch is persistent and constant prayer during times of uncertainty. Here's White again. He says, we find that just as battles often hinge on one focal point, so a simple request might be the key to resolving vast, complex issues. In place of a list of requests, we might make only one, provided we saw the battle as God saw it. Yeah, he's pointing to this fact that if we really believe that there's an all-powerful God waiting in the wings to answer and respond to our prayers, if we saw these difficult and uncertain situations the way that God did from his vantage point, the answer to resolving the whole thing really might just be one prayer request. He gives the example, White does, of Napoleon, old French general. Apparently Napoleon used to do this thing in battles. You know, he's a real short guy, right? And he'd get up on the highest vantage point that he could. And apparently in the middle of battles sometimes, Napoleon would see things way out. In one instance, he saw a bridge like a couple miles away. And he said to one of his generals, go get me that bridge. I don't care about anything else in this battle. None of it matters. I don't care how many men you lose. We could lose 3/4 of our army, but you go get me that bridge. Because if you get that bridge and if you hold it, we're going to win the battle. And he was able to identify that because of his vantage point and his military genius. And White's point here is that this is what God is like. He sees our lives from a vantage point that we don't. And he sees the hinge points, the crucial issues. And so many times, the key, the crux to the whole thing is persistent, constant, intercessory prayer. Where we enable it, we tap into God's power and his vantage point to respond in just the way that we need it. And in this situation, the key, the hinge point, to all of what God wanted to do here was him responding to Nehemiah's prayer for Artaxerxes to respond to this request. So I think what we pick up from this is no matter how much we plan and scheme and how strong of leaders we want to be, the last thing that we can afford to lose is prayer. If we lose that, we lose the war. So his prayer request gets answered. He goes back to Jerusalem. This is Jerusalem in the time of Nehemiah. You can see out here, this is where it kind of got built out during the zenith of their power, the Solomon years. That all has been destroyed. You've just got some peasant farmers living out in these regions to the east. They're basically reduced to what's the Temple Mount up here at the head and the city of David at the bottom, because it's a small remnant that's back in the city. And if you look at this map, all of these different gates that it points to, they've all been burned out by Nebuchadnezzar and these different raids, and a bunch of these walls have been destroyed. So Nehemiah goes back and he sets out this plan, this ingenious little plan. He divvies people up by household and he tells them, you've got one thing that I want you to work on. And he assigns them to a spot of the wall or a gate. And he says, your job is to get this done as fast as humanly possible. And so they work like madmen. And for a while, it's going really well. In Nehemiah 4, it says that we rebuilt the wall until it reached half its height, for the people worked with all their heart. So for a time, things are going really well. He has a good plan. People are listening. They're responding to his leadership. But inevitably, adversity pops up. When Sambalat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the people of Ashdod heard that the repairs to Jerusalem's walls had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were very angry, and they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem. So again, these surrounding enemies that had been keeping this remnant in check for decades, they hear that this wall is getting built, and so they all close in on the city from every single side. And so you can just imagine, being one of the Israelites, you're working on the wall, and you can see on every one of the surrounding hillsides, a camp, an army is creeping in on the city. And so naturally, they start to panic. They start to freak out. And here's where we pull out the second really important principle of Nehemiah's leadership through uncertainty. He was bold in the face of opposition. Boldness in the face of opposition. It says in verse 10, meanwhile, the people of Judah said, the strength of the laborers is giving out. There's so much rubble, we can't rebuild the wall. You don't hear any complaints from the people until they run into hardship and adversity. For a while, they're just like, yeah, rah, rah, we're doing it. Go Jerusalem, wall's going up. And then they see the scary men on the hills and they're like, it's impossible, the rubble. Look at the rubble, we can't do this. Also, our enemy said, before they know it or see us, we'll be right there among them. We'll kill them and put an end to their work. They're sowing distrust among the ranks. I don't know if it's spies or if they're creeping up to the rubble at night and they're just like, by the way, we're going to kill you. We're going to come in and kill you. But it works. The Jews who live near them, so the ones on the outskirts of the walls, told us 10 times over, wherever you turn, they're going to attack us. I don't know if you've had this. You're dealing with a problem and people just keep coming up to you and reminding you that the problem exists. He reiterates, it's 10 times over. They're like, they're going to come. We got to stop. We got to give up. So how does Nehemiah meet this crisis, this opposition? His response, I think, is so simple and profound. After looking things over, I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome. And fight for your families, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes. And that's all he says. That's it. Look what happens. Our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that God had frustrated it. And we returned to the wall and each to our own work. It works. That's it. That's all. All that Nehemiah has to do to embolden the people to the point where the enemies are like, all right, they know what's going on, and now we're freaked out. Our plans have been frustrated. All that Nehemiah really does is he says this, don't be afraid. How should you not be afraid? What's going to enable you to not be afraid? Remember the Lord, the great and awesome Lord. And boy, this is the key when facing adversity and difficulty, opposition. Remembering is where boldness comes from. Remembering what God is like and remembering the work that he's given us is good. It's a really simple equation, but those are, at the end of the day, the only two things that we need. And honestly, I think for us in our culture, something is kind of lost compared to them because we're not a storytelling culture like they were. For them, remembering was so important because they would share these stories with each other from birth about what God was like about Yahweh. And so when Nehemiah says this, when he says, hold on, pump the brakes, remember. Remember who's got your back. It's Yahweh. This is God. You know about him. Think about the stories. We're talking about Yahweh, who parted the Red Sea and led you through on dry land. We're talking about Yahweh, who led you as a pillar of cloud by day and fire by night. Yahweh, He stood in front of Mount Sinai and he lit the mountain on fire and spoke out of its midst. Yahweh, who made the Jordan stand on its end so you could walk through on dry ground. Yahweh, who lit those sacrifices of Jezebel's priests on fire and sent them scattering to the hills. Yahweh, remember that guy? Remember him? That's who has your back here. And the work that you're doing, it's good, it's right. He wants this for you. They had this. They had this remembering built into their DNA. We too need to have this. I think it's harder for us, especially in our tech-addicted time. We can't remember anything for 15 seconds because it's at our fingertips. To be able to pump the brakes and say to ourselves, who is the God that I think has my back? How has he provided for me in the past? And what's the work that I'm trying to do here? I mean, think about it. What are we talking about? We're not planning a freaking picnic here, right? We're talking about helping people pass from death to life. We're talking about suturing the wounds of people in a broken and fallen world with compassionate, joyful fellowship. If we remember the God that has our back and the good work that he set us out to, when those things occupy and fill the forefront of our mind, opposition, adversity, pandemic, fleas. What is that? That's nothing. It emboldens us. This is a characteristic that a strong leader in times of adversity has to have. They got to be reminders. Help people get up to that 30,000 point view and say, well, hold on. You've seen God take care of you before. You've got to believe that he's going to do it again. It's so cool to see the way that this simple remembering sets the people back on track. The other thing we see from Nehemiah here was he was creative in the face of these setbacks. So he reminds the people about what God is like, and he also comes up with a creative plan. He says, from that day on, half my men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears, shields, bow, and armors. The officers posted themselves behind all the people of Judah who were building the wall, and those who carried materials did their work with one hand and held a weapon in the other. Then I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, the work is extensive and spread out. We're widely separated from each other along the wall. Whenever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there and shout, our God will fight for us. And so we continued the work with half the men holding spears from the first light of dawn until the stars came out. So he reminds them, and then he comes up with a creative plan. He's like, all right, we are not a military people group. We're a small band of ragtag exiles. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to keep working. We can't stop the work because without the walls, we definitely die. But we're going to do the work with our brick and mortar in one hand and our swords in the other. Which would, if you think about it, be incredibly awkward. It's like you're trying to patch together this wall and you've got this big sword or bow in your offhand. He's like, all right, that's what we're going to do. When you think about that, this is not that great of a plan. They're spread out all along the wall. And he's like, all right, if somebody attacks, we're going to blow a trumpet. And we're going to shout. And that'll work. We'll go to where the trumpet is. They're not trained military regiments. I mean, this is really not that incredible or excellent of a plan here, but it's a plan. It's something. He came up with something, and it's kind of comical, but God used it. Something about this gave the people courage to keep working, knowing that at least we're trying something. And for some reason, their enemies, they saw this and they were freaked out. I don't know what it was about it. Maybe they looked in and they saw, so everybody was doing the work, young, old, common people, even the priests who never did any work except serve in the temple. And so maybe Sanballat's sitting up on a hill and he looks down and he sees this 90-year-old priest slugging away with mortar in one hand and a sword in another and a crazy look in his eyes. And Sanballat's like, that dude has one last fight in him. I don't want any piece of that. But what I like about Nehemiah here is he was willing to try something. He just gave it a shot. He took a crack at it. And God was able to use it. It's important because in times of uncertainty, people often feel powerless. They say, well, we've tried everything. There's nothing left to try. And that's always a lie. That's not true. One of the key features that God created us with is creativity. We mimic his mind in that way. He gave us our intellect, our reason, our creativity for a reason. And he empowers us, especially when we're trying to lead other people, to use that, to employ that in his service. And there's an onus here for spiritual leaders to be willing to keep trying things, to keep hacking away and trying to come up with new plans and ideas. An example of this I really like, this author, Randy Newman, he wrote this great book recently called Questioning Evangelism, about how to help people come to faith by leading them through these important, deep questions about life. And then just a couple years ago, he wrote this other book, Unlikely Converts, and in the intro to this book, he says, don't buy my old book. Rip it up. Questioning Evangelism, it's useless. And his point is, because people in our culture don't really ask questions anymore. We're not really a questioning culture. People like to make big, loud statements, but they don't like to ask questions. And so in the intro to Unlikely Converts, he's like, rip that book up, throw it away, here's a new idea, share your story with people. And then maybe they'll share theirs. And he talks about all these stories of people coming to faith. And what I like in this is a willingness to be flexible and creative and say that, undoubtedly, trying to lead people closer to God and reach people in our culture, it's constantly going to shift. But God's made us with minds that can shift too. And strong, creative leaders are ones that are equipped and ready to meet these challenges. And they lead people, they raise up people who think this way as well. When they run into adversity, there's almost a sense of excitement, anticipation. What are we going to try next? I know a lot of people felt that in the middle of the pandemic, where every new day there was a new edict from Lord DeWine on how we were supposed to go through life. And you had to roll with the punches. It was like, all right, we can't do that anymore. Let's try this. Servant leaders maintain that. Lastly, servant leaders look for opportunity in the midst of upheaval. Servant leaders look for opportunity in the midst of upheaval. In chapter 6, we read, the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. I mean, this was a monstrous thing that they had undertaken. In the midst of all this uncertainty, it took them 52 days to get this wall up. And look at what happened. When our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence. Why? Because of how awesome Nehemiah was? Because of how great of a leader he was? No. Because they couldn't help but realize that this work had been done with the help of our God. They look in and they're like, I guess there might be something to this Yahweh thing because there's no way they could have done that on their own. It's fascinating. What I think is really cool about this book is that this is not the climax of it. The climax of the book is not the completion of the wall, but actually what comes after, which is a spiritual revival unlike the nation of Israel had seen in 1,000 years. In chapter 8, it says, all the people came together as one in the square before the water gate. They told Ezra, the teacher of the law, to bring out the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had commanded for Israel. Ezra the priest brought the law before the assembly, which was made up of men and women and all who were able to understand. And he read it aloud from daybreak till noon. And all the people listened attentively to the book of the law. So this is something that they typically would do once a year. Everybody would get together and they would listen to the Pentateuch, the law, be taught. But for these guys, they'd probably never heard it. They're exiles. Their whole culture got shredded. For many of these people, this is probably the very first time that they ever heard the words of the law read. And so they're sitting there, and what are they reading? Well, they're reading those words that we opened our time here today with, what Moses said, sitting on Mount Nebo. They're reading that warning, stick with God. Don't abandon him. And they're realizing what had happened. So Nehemiah the governor, Ezra the priest, the teacher of the law, and the Levites were instructing the people and said to them, "This day is holy to the Lord. Don't mourn or weep, for the people have been weeping as they listen to the words of the law." Yeah, they're piecing it all together. Oh my God, we screwed up. All of this happened because we turned away from the Lord. And so they're in this state of mourning, exasperation. And I love what Nehemiah says in response. He says, "Go and enjoy choice food and sweet drinks. Go have a party. Send some to those who have nothing prepared. This day is holy to the Lord. Don't grieve, for the joy of the Lord is your strength." The joy of the Lord is your strength. I love that verse. They're in this state where they're realizing, oh man, we've turned away from God in so many ways. And what does Nehemiah say? He says, no. God's calling you back to him. Don't grieve, celebrate. Celebrate because you guys are turning back to the Lord. The joy of the Lord is your strength. So they party. They keep reading the law for a week and they party. All the people went away to eat and drink and said portions of food and to celebrate with great joy because they now understood the words that had been made known to them. From the days of Joshua, son of Nun, until that day, the Israelites had not celebrated like this. And their joy was very great. I think this is so cool. From the days of Joshua, think about what he's talking about. He's talking about the generation that entered into the promised land. He's saying that no generation of Israelites had been this close to God, this excited about him, since the people that watched the walls of Jericho fall at their feet, since the people that took hold of this whole great, beautiful land that God had given them. These guys were that close, that dependent on God in this moment. And I think that that is something that is so fascinating about this story. In the midst of all of this uncertainty and upheaval, what Nehemiah ends up seeing is he ends up seeing an opportunity for these people to become close to God. And close to God in a way that they weren't for 1,000 years when they were living under God's protection and blessing. At this moment, in this tiny God-forsaken city surrounded by enemies with most of their family and friends living as slaves in countries that they've never seen before, in this moment, they're infinitely closer to God than they were when they are at the height of their power. Why is that? So often, when people's worlds get flipped upside down, when they can't cling to the things that they're used to, the worldly things that they hold their security and sense of self and sense of purpose to, there's an opportunity there for them to understand and see that the only thing that's going to give them that lasting security and purpose and fulfillment is going to come from God. And man, that's why I think this is something that should really resonate to us in this time. Because when the status quo gets upended, when people can't cling to the things that they usually cling to, there's some spiritual sensitivity there. And God, I'm hopeful that that's something that we're going to be able to find in our situation right now. Because our world got flipped on its head. And everybody got thrown about like leaves in the wind. Their whole life reshaped and rescheduled and reformed. And things that they clung to and held to, that they thought they could take their sense of self for, were gone in an instant. Man, I keep asking myself this question. What happens when you take a bunch of people who are lonelier than they've ever been, trapped and isolated, who are aimless, unsure of the trajectory of their lives, with everything about where their lives were headed, they got put on hold and there's nothing they could do about it, cynical, because the world got upended and they couldn't say no, they couldn't pump the brakes. There's just a small thing, a tiny person floating around on this rock, controlled by forces that they can't control, realizing that for the first time. Bottled up, going through a mental health crisis unlike the world's ever seen. What happens when you take people like that? I'm thinking about our topic here this weekend of rediscovering community. What happens when you take people like that and you get them around a home church
where people aren't lonely. They've sustained incredible spiritual friendships. People aren't aimless. They've got a clear sense of mission and purpose to life. People aren't cynical. They have the hope of heaven that serves as a buoy that keeps them afloat at all times. And people aren't bottled up, but they're vulnerable, sharing their lives with other people. What happens when you take people like that and you get them around a home church like this? I think the answer is they come to faith. And hopefully a lot of them. And spiritual leaders in this situation, in this time, I hope that we're able to see an opportunity for God to reach people that may have been closed off to the gospel their entire lives. And we, like Nehemiah, even if it feels unrealistic, we can step up to the plate and say, God, I'm here. I know that you're good. I know that your work is good. I want to be used by you. And I think if a lot of us do that, we're going to find way more people are open to the gospel than we've ever seen.
Thanks that you are a loving and gentle leader to us, God, and that you are compassionate and gentle, taking care of us during hard times. Grateful that it's from that point that we can choose to love and serve and lead other people. So pray for all of us that you would help us to distill a couple of clear thoughts from this weekend of ways you're trying to use us to make our community a place that's more joyful, serving, and effective for you. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.